turned, louder and louder in his ears. He leaned on the cold stone, trying to prop himself up, until at last he slipped away into unconsciousness. Then there was a light, and a voice, and Hatch felt himself coming back from a long distance. He reached up to the light, then slipped and fell, sending one of Johnny's bones spinning away. He breathed in the air, no longer stuffy and poisonous, faintly perfumed with the smell of the sea. He seemed to have fallen into a larger tunnel as the slab that crushed his brother had rolled back. Hatch tried to speak, but could only croak. He gazed up into the light again, trying to focus his blurry eyes on who was behind it. Raising himself on shaky knees, he blinked and saw Reverend Clay staring back at him, dried blood caked around his nose, flashlight in hand.
"You,"
said Clay, disappointment huge in his voice. A large, thin cross of bright metal hung from his neck, one sharp edge covered in mud. Hatch swayed, still breathing the delicious air. Strength was returning, but he could not yet muster the energy to speak. Clay replaced the cross within his shirt and stepped closer, standing in the low doorway that Hatch himself had once stood in, more than 31 years before. "I took shelter near the mouth of the tunnel, and I heard your cries," the minister said. "On the third try I was able to shift the lever, and the end wall of the tunnel came away, opening this hole. What is this place? And what are you doing here?" He peered closer, shining the light into the chamber. "And what are all these bones that fell out with you?" Hatch held up his hand in response. After a moment's hesitation, Clay reached down, and Hatch staggered to his feet.
"Thank you," he gasped. "You saved my life."
Clay waved his hand in a gesture of irritation.
"This was the tunnel my brother was killed in. And those are his bones."
Clay's eyes widened. "Oh," he said, moving the light quickly away. "I'm very sorry."
"Did you see anyone else on the island?" Hatch asked urgently. "A young woman in a slicker, dark hair."
Clay shook his head. Hatch closed his eyes briefly, took a deep breath. Then he pointed down the newly exposed tunnel.
"This leads to the base of the water pit. Captain Needleman's in the treasure chamber. We have to stop him."
Clay frowned.
"Stop him from what?"
"He's about to open the casket that contains St. Michael's sword." A look of suspicion darted across the minister's face. A series of racking coughs seized Hatch.
"I've learned the sword's deadly. Radioactive."
Clay crossed his arms.
"It could kill us all, and maybe half the town of Stormhaven if it ever got out."
Clay remained silent, staring.
"Look," said Hatch, swallowing hard. "You were right. We never should have been digging for this treasure, but it's too late for that now. I can't stop him alone."
A new look suddenly crossed the minister's face. A look Hatch found hard to interpret. Clay's expression began to change, brighten, as if his face was suffused with inward light.
"I think I'm beginning to understand," he said,
almost to himself.
"Needleman sent a man to kill me," Hatch said. "He's become unhinged."
"Yes," said Clay, suddenly fervent.
"Yes, of course he has.
All we can hope now is that we're not too late." Hatch stepped carefully around the litter of bones.
"Rest easy, Johnny,"
he said under his breath. Then he led the way down the narrow, sloping tunnel, Woody Clay following closely behind. Chapter 57 Gerard Needleman knelt before the casket, motionless for what seemed an infinity of time.
The iron bands that surrounded it had been carefully cut away, one by one. As the precise white light of the acetylene torch freed each band, it had fallen away through the slots in the metal floor. Now only a single band remained, separated from the lock of the casket, but clinging to its side by a thick coating of rust. The lock had been cut, the seals broken. The sword was his to claim. And yet Needleman remained where he was, his fingers on the lid. Every sense seemed magnified. He felt alive, fulfilled in a way he had never dreamed possible. It was as if his entire past life was now just a colorless landscape, as if he had lived but to prepare for this moment. He inhaled slowly, then again. A slight tremor, perhaps the leaping of his heart, seemed to course through him. And then, with reverential slowness, he opened the lid. The interior of the box lay in shadow, but within Needleman could see a faint coruscation of gemstones. The long-hidden interior exhaled the warm, fragrant scent of myrrh. The sword itself lay on perfumed velvet. He reached inside and placed his hand on the hilt, his fingers sliding smoothly between the beaten gold basket and grip. The blade itself was hidden, sheathed in a magnificent gold and gem-encrusted scabbard. Carefully, he drew the scabbarded sword from the box. The velvet on which the sword lay dissolved instantly to a cloud of purple dust. He raised the sword, noting its heaviness with astonishment, and brought it carefully into the light. The scabbard and hilt were of Byzantine workmanship, fashioned of heavy gold, dating to perhaps the 8th or 9th century, an exceedingly rare rapier-like design. The repoussé and filigree were astonishingly delicate. In his vast studies, Needleman had never seen finer. He raised the scabbard and turned it to catch the light, feeling his heart almost stop as he did so. The face of the scabbard was thick with cabochon sapphires of a depth, color, and clarity that seemed impossible. He wondered what earthly force could bring such rich color to a gemstone. He turned his attention to the hilt. The knuckle bow and keyon sported 4 astonishing rubies, each equal to the famous DeLong Star, which Needleman knew was considered the most perfect gemstone in existence. But embedded at the bottom of the pommel was a great double-star ruby that far surpassed the DeLong in size, color, and symmetry. The stone, Needleman mused as he turned the hilt in the light, had no equal on earth. None. Decorating the ricasso, grip rings, and counterguard were a dazzling array of sapphires in a rainbow of colors. Blacks, oranges, midnight blues, whites, greens, pinks, and yellows, every one a perfect double star. Once again, never had he seen such rich, deep colors. Not in his most febrile dreams had he imagined such gemstones. Each was utterly unique. Each would command any price on the market. But to have them all set together in such a singular piece of Byzantine goldwork was inconceivable. Such an object had never existed in the world, nor could it exist again. It was without peer. With an absolute clarity of mind, Needleman could see that his vision of the sword had not been misplaced. If anything, he had underestimated its power. This was an artifact that could change the world. Now, at last, the moment had come. The hilt and the scabbard were extraordinary. The blade itself must be beyond conception. Grasping the hilt in his right hand and the scabbard in his left, he began to draw out the sword with exquisite slowness. The flood of intense pleasure changed first to perplexity, then shock, then wonderment. What emerged from the scabbard was a pitted, flattened, deformed piece of metal. It was scaly and mottled, oxidized to a strange purplish-black color with inclusions of some white substance. He drew it to its length and held it upright, gazing at the misshapen blade. Indeed, the word blade hardly described it at all. He wondered remotely what it could mean. Over the years, his mind had imagined this moment 100, even 1,000 times. Each time, the sword had looked different. But never had it looked like this. He reached out and stroked the rough metal, wondering at its curious warmth. Perhaps the sword had been caught in a fire and melted, then refitted with a new hilt. But what kind of fire would do this? And what kind of metal was it? Not iron. It would have rusted orange. And not silver, which turned black when oxidized. Neither platinum nor gold oxidized at all. And it was far, far too heavy to be tin or any of the baser metals. What metal oxidized purple? He turned the sword again and passed it through the air, and as he did so he recalled the Christian legend of the Archangel Saint Michael. An idea formed within him. Several times, late at night, he had dreamed the sword buried at the base of the water pit was, quite literally, the sword of legend. The sword of Saint Michael himself, conqueror of Satan. In the dream, when he gazed upon the sword, he'd suffered a blinding conversion, like Saint Paul on the road to Damascus. He had taken a curious kind of comfort in the fact that his rich imagination always faltered at this point. Nothing he could conceive was extraordinary enough to justify the veneration and dread that filled the ancient documents mentioning the sword. But if Saint Michael, the archangel of the sword, had fought Satan, his weapon would have been scorched and melted in the course of battle. Such a sword would be unlike any other. As was the thing he now held in his hands. He gazed at it anew, wonder and fear and uncertainty mingling within him. If this was such a sword, and what other explanation could there be, then it was evidence. It was proof of another world, of something beyond the material. The resurrection of such a sword would be a spectacular event. Yes, yes, he nodded to himself. With such a sword, he could cleanse the world. He could sweep away the spiritual bankruptcy, give the fatal thrust to the world's decaying religions and their dying priesthoods, establish something new for a new millennium. His holding the sword was no accident. He had won it with his sweat and his blood. He had proven himself worthy of it. The sword was the proof he had been longing for his entire life. His treasure, above any other. With trembling arm he rested the heavy weapon on the open lid of the casket. Once again he found himself astonished by the contrast between the supernatural loveliness of the hilt and the twisted ugliness of the blade. But now it had a kind of wonderful awfulness, a delicious, an almost holy kind of hideousness. It was his now, and he had all the time in the world to consider, and perhaps in time comprehend its strange and terrible beauty. He carefully slid the blade back into its scabbard, glancing over at the casket as he did so. He would bring it to the surface as well. The casket had its own importance, bound up inseparably with the sword's history. Looking over his shoulder, he was pleased to see that Magnuson had at last lowered the bucket into the chamber and was loading it with sacks of coins. Slowly, like an automaton. He returned his attention to the casket and the one iron band that remained, rusted in place around one side. It was a strange way to strap down such a casket. Surely it would have been easier to bolt the straps to the floor of the treasure chamber instead of running them underneath. What were they attached to below? He backed up and kicked the last iron band, freeing the casket. The band broke away and shot down through the hole with amazing force, as if it had been attached to a great weight. Suddenly, there was a shudder, and the treasure chamber gave a great lurch, the right end of the floor dropping sickeningly, like an airplane plunging in violent turbulence. Rotten crates, canvas bags, and kegs tumbled from their positions along the left-hand wall, bursting upon the floor, showering gemstones, gold dust, and pearls. Stacks of gold bars leaned over heavily, then toppled in a great crash. Needleman was thrown against the casket, and he reached out for the hilt of the sword, ears ringing with Magnuson's screams, his eyes wide with astonishment.
Chapter 58. The lift's electronic motor whined as it sank into the pit. Streeter stood in one corner, gun in hand, forcing Rankin and Bonterre close to the opposite edge.
"Lyle, you must listen," Bonterre pleaded. "Roger says there is a huge void underneath us. He saw everything on the sonar screen. The pit and the treasure chamber are built on top of—"
"You can tell your friend Hatch about it," said Streeter, "if he's still alive."
"What have you done with him?"
Streeter raised the barrel. "I know what you were planning."
"Mon Dieu, you are just as paranoid."
"Shut up. I knew Hatch couldn't be trusted. I knew from the moment I set eyes on him. Sometimes the captain's a little naive that way. He's a good man, and he trusts people. That's why he's always needed me. I bided my time, and time proved me right. As for you, bitch, you chose the wrong side. And so did you." Streeter waved the gun in Rankin's direction. The geologist was standing at the edge of the lift, good hand holding the railing, wounded hand held tight beneath the armpit.
"You're insane,"
he said. Bonterre looked at him. The great bear of a man, normally affable and easygoing, was filled with a rage she had never seen in him before.
"Don't you get it?" Rankin snapped. "That treasure's been soaking up radiation for hundreds of years. It's no good to anyone."
"Keep running your mouth and I'll put my boot in it," Streeter said.
"I don't give a damn what you do," Rankin said. "The sword's gonna kill us all anyway."
"Bullshit."
"It's not bullshit. I saw the readings. The levels of radiation coming from that casket are unbelievable. When he takes that sword out, we're all dead."
They passed the 50-foot platform, the dull metal of the titanium spars bathed in the glow of emergency lights.
"You think I'm some kind of idiot," Streeter said. "Or maybe you're so desperate you'd say anything to save your ass.
That sword's 500 years old at least. Nothing on Earth is that naturally radioactive."
"Nothing on Earth. Exactly."
Rankin leaned forward, his shaggy beard dripping.
"That sword was made from a fucking meteorite."
"What?" Bonterre breathed. Streeter barked a laugh, shaking his head.
"The rad meter picked up the emission signature of iridium-80. That's a heavy isotope of iridium. Radioactive as shit."
He spat over the side of the lift.
"Iridium is rare on Earth, but common in nickel-iron meteorites."
He rocked forward, wincing with pain as his shattered hand grazed the platform.
"Streeter, you must let us speak to the captain," Bonterre said.
"That's not going to happen. The captain's spent a lifetime working for this treasure.
He talks about it, even in his sleep. That treasure belongs to him.
Not some hairy-ass geologist who joined the team 3 months ago. Or a French whore. It's his. All of it. Raw anger flared in Rankin's eyes. You pathetic bastard.
Streeter's lips compressed to a thin white line, but he said nothing.
You know what? Rankin said. The captain doesn't give a shit about you. You're even more dispensable now than you were back in Nam. Think he'd save your life now? Forget it. All he cares about is his goddamn treasure. Your history.
Streeter whipped the gun to Rankin's face, jamming it between his eyes.
Go ahead, Rankin said. Either do me and get it over with, or drop the gun and fight. I'll kick your puny ass with only one hand.
Streeter swiveled the gun toward the lift railing and fired. Gore flew against the scribbled walls of the pit as Rankin jerked his ruined left hand away. The geologist dropped to his knees, crying in pain and outrage, the index and middle fingers hanging by torn strips of flesh. Streeter began aiming calculated, vicious kicks at Rankin's face. With a cry, Bonterre threw herself at the team leader. Suddenly, a throaty rumble roared up from the depths. It was followed a split second later by a jarring blow that threw them all down onto the platform. Rankin reared back, unable to gain a purchase with his shattered hands, and Bonterre grabbed his shirt collar to keep him from tumbling over the edge. Streeter recovered first, and by the time Bonterre rose, he was already gripping the rail, aiming his gun at them. The entire structure was shaking violently, titanium struts screeching in protest. Beneath it all was the demonic roar of rushing water. The lift lurched to a shrieking halt.
Don't move, Streeter warned.
Another jarring shudder, and the emergency lights flickered. A bolt fell past, glanced off the platform with a clang, and went spinning down into darkness.
It's begun,
Rankin cried hoarsely, huddled on the floor of the lift, hugging his bleeding hands to his chest.
What has begun?
Bonterre shouted.
The pit's collapsing into the piercement dome. Great fucking timing.
Shut up and jump down. Streeter waved his gun at the gray shape of the 100-foot platform, silhouetted a few feet below the lift. Another jolt shook the lift, canting it crazily. A rush of chill air gusted up from the depths.
Timing, Bonterre shouted. This is no coincidence. This is McKellen's secret trap.
I said, shut up. Streeter shoved her off the lift and she tumbled several feet, landing hard on the 100-foot platform. She looked up, shaken but unhurt, to see Streeter kicking Rankin in the abdomen. 3 kicks and he was over the edge, landing heavily beside her. Bonterre moved to help, but Streeter was already clambering cat-like down the array to the platform.
Don't touch him, he said, twitching the pistol warningly. We're going in there.
Bonterre looked over. The bridge from the ladder array to the Wapner tunnel was trembling. As she stared, there came another violent shudder. The emergency lighting went out, and the web of struts plunged into darkness.
Move it, Streeter hissed in her ear.
Then he stopped. Even in the darkness, Bonterre could feel him tense. Then she saw it too, a faint light below them, rising quickly up the ladder.
Captain Needleman, Streeter called down.
There was no answer.
Is that you, Captain?
He called again, louder, trying to make his voice heard over the thundering roar welling up from below. The light kept coming. Now Bonterre could see it was pointed downward, its brightness obscuring the climbing figure.
You down there, Streeter called. Show your face or I'll shoot!
A muffled voice came up, faint and unintelligible.
Captain!
The light came closer, perhaps 20 feet below now. Then it snapped off.
Christ, Streeter said again, bracing himself against the shaking platform, planting his legs apart and aiming downward, both hands on the gun. Whoever it is, he roared, I'm going to—
But even as he spoke, there was a sudden rush from the other side of the platform. Taken by surprise, Streeter spun around and fired, and in the flare of the muzzle, Bonterre could see Hatch slamming his fist into Streeter's gut. Hatch followed the blow to Streeter's abdomen with a straight arm to the jaw. Streeter staggered backward on the metal platform, and Hatch came quickly after, catching a handful of Streeter's shirt and spinning him around. Streeter began to twist from Hatch's grip, and Hatch pulled him forward, punching him twice, hard in the face. On the second blow, there was a low crunching noise as Streeter's sinuses gave way with a splatter of mucus and hot, thick blood. Streeter moaned and went limp, and Hatch relaxed his grip. Suddenly, Streeter's knee came up. Grunting in surprise and pain, Hatch fell backward. Streeter went for his gun. There was nothing he could do but shove the man hard toward the floor. Streeter lifted his gun as Hatch dove for the far side of the array. There was a roar and a burst of light, and a bullet sparked off a titanium member to his left. Hatch ducked to one side, swinging around as another bullet whined between the braces. Then Hatch heard a gasp and a low grunt. Bonterre was grappling Streeter from behind. He lunged forward just as Streeter gave her a brutal backhand that sent her spinning toward the mouth of the tunnel. Quick as a cat, Streeter brought the gun forward again. Hatch froze, his fist hanging in midair, staring at the dim line of the gun barrel. Streeter looked into his eyes and smiled, blood from his nose staining his teeth a dull crimson. Then he lurched to one side. Rankin, unable to use his hands, had risen up and was butting Streeter toward the edge of the metal bridge with his body. For a moment, Streeter seemed on the verge of toppling, but he regained his balance and, as Hatch brought his arm back for a blow, turned the gun on Rankin and fired point blank. The geologist's head jerked back, a dark spray rising behind in the gloom of the tunnel. Then he slumped to the metal flooring. But Hatch's fist was already in motion, connecting heavily with Streeter's jaw even as he wheeled backward. Streeter staggered heavily against the railing, and there was a protest of metal. Instantly, Hatch stepped forward, shoving hard with both hands. The railing gave as Streeter sagged back. He toppled into space, scrabbling frantically for a purchase. There was a gasp of surprise or pain, the crack of a pistol shot, the sickening sound of meat smacking metal. Then, more distantly, a splash that merged with the general rush of water far below. The entire fight had lasted less than a minute. Hatch rose to his feet, gasping from the exertion. He walked over to the inert form of Rankin, Bonterre already at the geologist's side. A single flash of livid lightning, reflected down through the tracery of struts, made it all too clear there was nothing he could do. There was a grunt. The flashlight beam flared wildly. Then Woody Clay heaved himself up onto the 100-foot platform, sweat and dried blood mixing on his face. He had come up from below slowly as a decoy, while Hatch had clambered quickly up the back side of the array to surprise Streeter. Hatch was crushing Bonterre to him, his hands in the tangle of her dark hair.
"Thank God," he breathed. "Thank God. I thought you were dead."
Clay watched them for a moment.
"I saw something fall past me," he said. "Were those gunshots?"
Hatch's answer was interrupted by a sudden crash. Moments later, a large titanium spar came hurtling past them, raising fierce clangs as it bounced downward. The entire array quivered along its 150-foot length. Hatch pushed Bonterre and Clay across the shaking metal bridge into the nearby tunnel.
"What the hell's going on?" he panted. "Gerard has opened the casket," Bonterre said. "He's set off the final trap."
Chapter 59. Needleman watched, paralyzed with shock, as a series of violent tremors shook the treasure chamber. Another sickening lurch, and the floor canted farther to the right. Magnuson, who had been thrown against the far wall by the first jolt, now lay partly buried in a great mass of coins, thrashing and clawing, crying out in an otherworldly voice.
The chamber lurched again, and a row of casks toppled over, bursting in a rotten spray of wood, filling the air with gold and jewels. The shifting of the casket beneath him shook Needleman from his paralysis. He shoved the sword into his harness and looked about for his dangling lifeline. There it was, just above him, rising through the hole in the top of the treasure chamber. Far above, he could make out the thin glow of emergency lights at the base of the ladder array. As he watched, they winked out briefly, then flickered into life once again. He reached for the lifeline just as another terrible lurch came. Suddenly there was a screech of tearing iron as the seam along the far edge of the floor split open. Needleman watched in horror as the masses of loose gold slid toward the open seam, piling up against it, whirlpooling like water in a bathtub drain, pouring through the widening crack into a stormy black gulf below.
"No, no,"
Magnuson cried, scrabbling through the hemorrhaging flow of treasure, even at this desperate extreme, hugging and grasping the gold to her, caught between saving the coins and saving herself. A shudder that seemed to come from the center of the earth twisted the chamber, and a hailstorm of golden ingots buried themselves in the masses of coin around her. As the weight of the gold became greater and the whirlpool faster, Magnuson was sucked into the flow and pulled along toward the widening crack, her cries of no, 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 almost drowned by the roar of metal. She wordlessly stretched her arms toward Needleman, eyes popping as her body was compressed by the weight of the gold. The vault echoed with the groan of buckling iron and the snapping of bolts. And then Magnuson disappeared, sucked into the shimmering golden stream and down into the void. Abandoning the lifeline, Needleman scrambled up the shifting pile of gold and managed to grasp the swinging metal bucket. Reaching inside, he punched a button in the electrical box. The winch whined, and the bucket began to ascend, Needleman hanging beneath as the bucket scraped along the crazily angled roof of the iron vault before sliding up through the narrow cut. As he slowly ascended the excavation toward the base of the ladder array, Needleman hoisted himself into the bucket and glanced over its lip. He caught the last glimpse of a vast quantity of treasure. Tusks, bolts of rotten silk, kegs, bags, gold, gems, vanishing in a great rattling rush through the crack in the treasure chamber below. Then the light, swinging wildly on its cord, smashed against the iron wall and was extinguished. The entire shaft went dark, lit only by the emergency lights from the array above his head. In the gloom, he saw, or thought he saw, the mangled treasure vault break free of the walls of the pit and drop downward into a swirling chaos of water, sucked under with a final groan of iron. A great tremor shook the shaft. Dirt and sand rained down, and the titanium bracings above gave a howl of protest. There was another flicker, and the emergency lights failed. The bucket came to a wrenching stop just below the ladder array, banging both sides of the narrow shaft. Making sure the sword was secure, Needleman reached up toward the winch rope, groping in the darkness. His fingers brushed against the lowest pilings of the array. Another terrible shudder twisted the pit, and he lunged upward with desperate strength, hoisting himself to the first rung, then the second, his feet dangling over the ruinous chasm. The entire support structure of the pit was trembling under the strain, buckling like a live thing under his hands. There was a snapping sound in the darkness as one of the lower struts popped free. In the glow of a remote flash of lightning, he could see a broken body bobbing in the watery ruin far beneath his feet. As he hung from the array, gasping for air, the enormity of the disaster began to sink in. He dangled motionless for a second as his mind sought answers. Then a vast, black rage crept over his features, and his mouth opened, wailing even over the roar of the void beneath him.
Hatch!
Chapter 60
"What are you talking about?"
Hatch asked, leaning against the wet tunnel wall, fighting for breath. "What final trap?"
"According to Roger, the water pit was built above a formation called a piercement dome," Bonter shouted. "A natural void that goes deep into the earth. McKellen planned to snare Occam with it."
"And we thought bracing the pit would take care of everything."
Hatch shook his head.
"McKellen, he always was one step ahead of us.
These struts of titanium are holding the pit together, temporarily. Otherwise, the whole thing would have collapsed by now."
"And Needleman?"
"Seppa? He probably fell into the void with the treasure."
"In that case, let's get the hell out of here."
He turned toward the mouth of the tunnel just as another violent tremor shook the array. In the moment of silence that followed, a low beeping sounded from beneath Bonter's sweater. She reached in, drew out the rad meter, and handed it to Hatch.
"I got this from your office," she said. "I had to break a few things to find it."
The display was dim. The battery was obviously low, but the message displayed across the top of the screen was all too clear. 244.13 rads per hour. Fast neutron flux detected. General radiation contamination probable. Recommendation, immediate evacuation.
"Maybe it's picking up residual radiation," Bonter suggested, peering at the screen.
"The hell it is. 244 rads? Let me see if I can bring the locator up."
He glanced at Clay, who obliged by turning the flashlight beam toward the machine. Hatch began stabbing at the miniature keyboard. The warning message disappeared, and the three-dimensional coordinate grid once again filled the screen. Standing, Hatch began to move the detector around. A blazing, rainbow-colored spot blossomed in the center of the screen, colors shifting as he turned.
"Oh, my God."
He looked up from the screen.
"Needleman's not dead. He's on the ladder now, below us. And he's got the sword."
"What?"
Bonter breathed. "Look at these readings." Hatch turned the rad meter toward her. A ragged patch of white showed on its display, oscillating wildly.
"Christ! He must be getting a massive dose from the sword."
"How much of a dose?" Clay asked, his voice strained.
"What I want to know is, how much of a dose are we getting?"
Bonter asked. "We're not in immediate danger. Yet. There's a lot of intervening ground. But radiation poisoning is cumulative. The longer we stay, the bigger the dose." Suddenly the earth shook like a possessed thing. A few feet down the tunnel, a massive beam gave way with a loud crack. Dirt and pebbles rained around them.
"What are we waiting for?"
Bonter hissed, turning toward the depths of the tunnel.
"Let's go!"
"Wait!"
Hatch cried, the rad meter buzzing in his hands.
"We cannot wait,"
Bonter said.
"Can this tunnel lead us out?"
"No. The base of the well was sealed off when the Reverend reset the trap."
"So let's climb out the pit. We cannot stay here."
She began walking toward the array. Hatch pulled Bonter roughly back into the tunnel.
"We can't go out there," he hissed.
"Why not?"
Clay was now at their side, looking intently at the screen. Hatch glanced at him, briefly surprised at the look of suppressed excitement, almost triumph on the minister's face.
"According to this,"
Hatch said slowly, "that sword is so radioactive that even 1 second's exposure to it gives a lethal dose. Needleman's out there now, and he's climbing toward us. If we so much as peek out into the main shaft, we're toast."
"Then why is he not dead?"
"He is dead. Even the most massive doses of radiation take time to kill. He was dead the moment he laid eyes on that sword. And we're dead, too, if we get within a sight line of it. Neutron radiation propagates through the air like light. It's vital that we keep rock and earth between him and us." He stared at the rad meter. He's maybe 50 feet below now. Maybe less. Go back down this tunnel as far as you dare. With luck, he'll climb right past us.
Over the uprushing of sound, Hatch heard an indistinct shout. Gesturing for the others to stay back, he crept forward, halting just before the mouth of the shaft. Beyond, the web of titanium struts shivered and swayed. A low-battery alarm began sounding on the rad meter, and he looked down to check the display. 3,217.89 rads per hour. Fast neutron flux detected. Immediate evacuation critical.
Christ, he thought. It's redlined.
They were still within safety limits, shielded by the rock and dirt of the water pit. But Needleman was closer now, and soon not even the intervening earth would...
Hatch!
Came the hoarse, ragged voice. Hatch paused.
I found Lyle's body.
Still, Hatch said nothing. Could Needleman know where he was? Or was he merely bluffing?
Hatch! Don't be coy. It doesn't suit you. I saw your light. I'm coming for you. Do you hear me?
Needleman!
He yelled in return. There was no answer. He glanced back at the rad meter. The whitish blob on the screen kept ascending the grid, flickering in and out with the waning power of the battery.
Captain, stop! We need to talk!
By all means, we'll have a nice little talk.
You don't understand,
Hatch cried, inching even closer to the edge. The sword is highly radioactive. It's killing you, Captain.
Get rid of it, now!
He waited, straining to hear above the uprushing roar.
Ah, the endlessly inventive Hatch,
came Needleman's voice, faint and unnaturally calm.
You planned this disaster very well.
Captain, for Christ's sakes, drop the sword!
Drop it, came the answer. You set this trap. Wreck the water pit. Kill my crew. Deprive me of my treasure. And now you want me to drop the sword? I don't think so.
What the hell are you talking about?
Don't be diffident. Take credit for your fine work. A few well-placed explosives did the trick, right?
Hatch rolled onto his back, staring at the ceiling, searching for options.
You're a sick man, Captain, he called out. If you don't believe me, ask your own body. The sword is a powerful emitter of fast neutron radiation. It's already stopped all cell mitosis and DNA synthesis in your body. Soon you'll be suffering from cerebral syndrome, the most severe form of radiation poisoning.
He listened. Except for the roar of the great gulf beneath, the only sound he heard was the dying chirp of the rad meter. He took a deep breath.
You're already in the prodromal period, he called out. First you'll begin to feel nauseated. You probably do already, don't you? Next will come confusion, as inflammatory foci sprout up in your brain. Then tremors, ataxia, convulsions, and death.
There was no answer.
For God's sake, Needleman, listen to me, he cried. You're going to kill us all with that sword.
No, came the voice from below. No, I think I'll use my gun.
Hatch sat up fast. The voice was closer now, very close, no more than 15 feet away. He retreated down the tunnel to the others.
What is happening?
Bonterre cried.
He'll be here in a few seconds, Hatch replied. He's not going to stop.
As he spoke, he realized with grim finality that there was nothing they could do. They had no escape route. Another moment or two, and Needleman would appear over the lip of the tunnel, sword in hand. and they would all be dead.
"Is there no way to stop him?" Bonter cried.
Before Hatch could answer, Clay spoke.
"Yes," he said in a strong, clear voice. "Yes, there is."
Hatch turned. The look on Clay's cadaverous face was not only triumphant, it was ecstatic, beatific, otherworldly.
"What?"
Hatch began, but Clay had already brushed past him, light in hand. In a flash, Hatch understood.
"Don't do it!" he cried, grabbing for Clay's sleeve. "It's suicide! The sword will kill you!"
"Not until I've done what I came to do."
Clay jerked his arm free and raced to the lip of the tunnel. Then, skirting Rankin's body, he leaped across the metal bridge to the array and descended quickly out of view.
Chapter 61.
Clinging to the rungs of the array, Clay climbed down a few feet, then paused to steady himself. A great roar was coming from the depths of the pit. The sounds of collapsing caverns and thunderous water, of violent chaos churning in the unguessable depths. An uprush of damp air tugged and worried at the collar of his shirt. He angled his flashlight downward. The ventilation system had shut down when the emergency power failed, and the air was heavy. The shaking spars were dripping with condensation, striped with clots of falling dirt. The beam licked through the fog, settling at last on the form of Needleman, perhaps 10 feet below. The captain was toiling painfully up the ladder, grasping each rung in the crook of his arm before hauling himself up to the next, his face contorted with effort. With every shudder of the ladder, he paused, hugging the rungs in both hands. Tucked into Needleman's back harness, Clay saw the flash of a jeweled hilt.
"Well, well," croaked Needleman, staring up toward the flashlight. "Et lux in tenebris lucet. The light does shine in the darkness indeed. Why am I not surprised to find the good reverend part of this conspiracy?"
His voice dissolved into a hacking cough, and he clung to the ladder with both hands through another nasty shudder.
"Toss the sword," Clay said.
Needleman's answer was to reach into his belt and remove a handgun. Clay ducked to the far side of the array as the gun roared.
"Out of my way," Needleman rasped.
Clay knew he couldn't confront Needleman on these narrow rungs. He'd have to find a place with better footing. Quickly he scanned the array with his flashlight. A few feet below, at the 110-foot mark, was a narrow maintenance bar. He put the flashlight in his pocket and used the darkness to descend one rung, then another. The array was trembling more violently now. Clay knew that Needleman couldn't climb as long as he held the gun. But he also knew that the shaking came in waves, and as soon as the vibration ended, Needleman would put a bullet in him. He dropped 2 more rungs in the blackness, feeling his way with his hands and feet as the shaking eased. A faint flare of reflected lightning showed Needleman a few feet below him, hoisting himself toward the maintenance spar with one hand. He was already off balance, and Clay, with a desperate movement, dropped another rung and, with all his energy, kicked out at the captain's hand. There was a roar and a clatter as his foot connected, and the gun fell away into darkness. Clay slid down onto the spar, his feet slipping on the narrow metal grating. Needleman, dangling below, howled with inarticulate rage. With a sudden flurry of energy, he scrambled onto the narrow platform. Keeping the frame of the array between them, Clay took out his flashlight and shone it at the captain. Needleman's face was streaked with sweat and dirt, skin frighteningly pallid, eyes sunken in the pitiless beam of the light. He seemed wasted, drawn, his body fueled only by the hard core of some inner will, and his hand trembled slightly as he reached behind him and drew out the sword. Clay stared at it with a mixture of dread and wonder. The hilt was mesmerizingly beautiful, studded with huge gemstones. But the blade itself was an ugly, mottled violet, a pitted and scarred piece of metal.
Step aside, Reverend, the captain croaked. I'm not going to waste my energy with you. I want Hatch.
Hatch isn't your enemy.
Did he send you to say that? Needleman coughed again. I had McCallan soundly defeated. But I underestimated Hatch's treachery. Him and his operatives. No wonder he wanted Truett on the dig team. And I suppose your protest was a ruse to distract my attention.
He stared at Clay, eyes glittering.
You're a dead man, Clay said calmly. We're both dead men. You can't save your body, but perhaps you can still save your soul. That sword is a weapon of the devil. Cast it into the depths where it belongs. Foolish man, Needleman hissed, advancing. A weapon of the devil, you say? Hatch may have cost me the treasure, but I still have this. The sword I've spent the better part of my life preparing to claim.
It's been the instrument of your death, Clay replied evenly.
No, but it may be the instrument of yours. For the last time, Reverend, stand aside.
No, said Clay, clinging to the shaking platform.
Then die, cried Needleman, bringing the heavy blade around and swinging it toward Clay's head.
Chapter 62 Hatch tossed the now-dead radmeter away and peered out into the darkness, toward the mouth of the tunnel and the vertical shaft of the water pit beyond. There had been vague sounds of voices, the flare of Clay's flashlight silhouetting the metal skeleton of the ladder array, a gunshot sharp and clear above the cavernous roar. He waited in an agony of uncertainty, the temptation to creep forward and take a brief look over the edge almost overwhelming. But he knew that even an instant's exposure to St. Michael's sword meant lingering death. He glanced back toward Bonterre. He could feel the tension in her body, hear her choppy breathing. Suddenly, the sounds of a furious struggle erupted. There was the sound of metal striking metal, a hideous cry, "Whose?" followed by a strangled gibbering, then another great blow and clang of metal. Next came a terrible cry of pain and despair that receded until it, too, died into the roar of the pit. Hatch crouched, riveted in place by the horrifying sounds. Then came more. Ragged breathing, the slap of a hand against metal, a grunt of effort. A flashlight beam flared upward, searched the wall around them, then stopped, pinpointing the mouth of their tunnel. Someone was climbing. Hatch tensed, options racing through his mind. He realized there was only one. If Clay had failed, somebody else had to stop Needleman, and he was determined it would be himself. In the darkness beside him, he felt Bonterre gathering herself to move, and he realized the same thought was in her mind as well. "Don't even think about it," he said.
"Fermala," she cried. "I will not let you..."
Before Bonterre could scramble to her feet, Hatch jumped forward, half-running, half-stumbling toward the mouth of the tunnel. He poised on the brink, steeling himself, hearing her feet behind him. He leaped forward onto the metal bridge, ready to grab Needleman and carry him into the roaring maw beneath. 3 feet down the ladder, Clay was struggling upward, his sides heaving, a large gash across one temple. The minister wearily placed a hand on the next rung of the array. Hatch bent down, hauling him onto the platform as Bonterre arrived. Together they helped him into the shelter of the tunnel. The minister stood silently, leaning forward, head lolling, arms supported on his thighs.
"What happened?" Hatch asked.
Clay looked up.
"I got the sword," he said in a faraway voice. "I threw it into the pit."
"And Needleman?" He decided to go after it.
There was a silence.
You saved our lives, Hatch said. My God, you...
He paused and took a breath.
We'll get you to a hospital.
Clay waved his hand wearily.
Doctor, don't. Please dignify my death with the truth.
Hatch looked at him a moment.
There's nothing medicine can do except make it less painful. I wish there was some way to repay your sacrifice,
Bonterre said, voice husky. Clay smiled, a strange smile that seemed partly rueful, partly euphoric.
I knew exactly what I was doing. It wasn't a sacrifice. It was a gift.
He looked at Hatch.
I have one favor to ask you. Can you get me to the mainland in time? I'd like to say goodbye to Claire.
Hatch turned his face away.
I'll do my best, he murmured.
It was time to go. They left the tunnel and crossed the shaking metal catwalk to the array. Hatch heaved Bonterre onto the ladder and waited as she began climbing into the darkness. As he looked up, lightning blazed across the sky and illuminated Orthanc, a dim specter far above, almost lost among the tracery of supports and beams. Curtains of rain, metal, and soil washed down, ricocheting through the complex matrix of the array.
Now you! Hatch shouted to Clay.
The minister handed him the flashlight, then turned wearily to the ladder and began to climb. Hatch watched him for a moment. Then, taking a powerful grip, he leaned out over the edge of the platform and shone the flashlight down into the pit. He stared after the beam, almost dreading what he might see. But the sword and Needleman were gone. Hatch could see a roiling cloud of mist cloaking the roaring gulf far beneath. There was another sickening lurch, and he turned back to the array and began to climb. All too soon he caught up with Clay. The minister was clutching a titanium rung, gasping for breath. Another great wave shook the ladder, shivering the remaining struts and filling the pit with the protest of deforming metal.
I can't go any farther, Clay gasped. You go on ahead.
Take the light, Hatch shouted. Then wrap an arm around my neck. Clay began to shake his head in protest. Do it! Hatch started upward again, hauling the minister up each rung. In the gleam of the flashlight he could see Bonterre above them, concern visible on her face as she looked down. Go! Go! He urged, willing himself upward one rung at a time. He gained the 50-foot platform and continued, not daring to stop for a rest. Above he could now make out the mouth of the water pit, dark black against the gray of the stormy sky. His muscles screamed as he forced himself upward, lifting Clay with each step. Then the array gave another great lurch, and a blast of wet air and spray burst up from below. With a high-pitched tearing sound, a huge piece of the array came loose below them. Knocked against the metal railing, Hatch could see the cribbing on either side of the shaft begin to split and unravel. Beside him, Clay gasped, fighting to hold on. Hatch scrambled upward again, fear and adrenaline sending new strength coursing through him. Directly above now, Bonterre was clambering up the array, her sides heaving. He followed, hoisting Clay along, sucking air into his lungs as fast as he could. The rungs of the ladder grew slicker. Here, nearer the surface, the roar and shriek of the collapsing pit mingled with the howl of the storm. Rain began to lash his face, warm after the foul chill of the tunnel. There was a violent tremor from deep within the pit, and the array gave an almost human shriek as countless supports gave way. Torn from its anchors, the ladder swung violently from side to side, slashing through a forest of twisted metal.
Go!
Hatch roared, pushing Bonterre in front of him. As he turned to follow, he saw with horror the bolts along the central spine of the ladder begin to burst,
unzipping like a jacket. Another massive tremor, and the anchor supports of Orthanc began to buckle above their heads. There was a loud popping sound, and one of the great observation windows dissolved into shards, raining down into the pit. "Look out!" Hatch cried, closing his eyes as the rain of glass and debris came crashing past. He felt the world begin to tilt, and he opened them again to see the ladder array folding in on itself. With a lurch that brought his gut into his throat, the entire structure dropped several feet, accompanied by a chorus of twisting and snapping. Clay almost broke free, his legs swinging over the void. "Onto the cribbing!" Hatch cried. He inched across a pair of struts, still supporting Clay. Bonterre followed. Grabbing Clay around the middle, Hatch hoisted him onto a titanium anchor bolt, then onto the old wooden cribwork that braced the sides of the pit. "Can you make it?" he asked. Clay nodded. Hatch clambered up below the minister, searching for handholds along the slimy, rotten face, urging Clay on. A piece of cribbing gave way beneath Hatch's feet, then another, and he scrabbled furiously for a moment before finding another purchase. He reached up, grabbed the bottom of the staging platform, and with Bonterre's help managed to haul the minister onto the platform and then to the grassy bank beyond. Hatch clambered to his feet. To the south he could see the dim shape of the rising tide pouring through a gap in the cofferdam. Bloated rain clouds scudded across the shrouded moon. All around the reefs the sea had been whipped white, the riptide carrying the line of foam as far as the horizon. A thunderous clang from above spun him around. Freed from its foundations, Orthanc was twisting around, folding in on itself. "To the dock!" Hatch shouted. He grabbed Bonterre and they ran, supporting Clay between them, down the muddy trail toward Island One. Hatch glanced back to see the observation tower plunging downward, punching through the staging platform on its way into the pit. Then the crash of a freight train gusted up from below, followed by a roar of water and a strange crackling sound, the snapping of countless wooden timbers as they pulled away from the loosening walls. A cloud of mist and water, mingled with yellow vapors and atomized mud, shot from the pit and billowed into the night sky. They moved as quickly as they could down the maze of trails to the deserted base camp and the dock beyond. The pier, sheltered by the lee of the island, was battered but intact. At its end, the launch from the Cerberus bobbed crazily in the waves. In a moment, they were aboard. Hatch felt for the key, turned it, and heard himself shout out loud as the engine roared to life. He flicked on the bilge pump and heard its reassuring gurgle. They cast off and headed out into the storm. "We'll take the Griffin," Hatch said, aiming for Needleman's command boat, still stubbornly riding its anchors out beyond the reefs. "The tide's turned. We'll be going before the wind." Bonterre nodded, hugging her sweater around her. "With a following sea and tide. Good luck for a change." They came alongside the Griffin and Hatch secured the launch, keeping it steady in the pitching surf while Bonterre helped Clay on board. As Hatch clambered up behind and ran to the pilot house, lightning tore a jagged path over the island. He watched in horror as an entire section of the cofferdam collapsed. A great wall of water lunged through, pale against the dark sky as it enveloped the southern shore of the island in a mantle of white. Bonterre brought in the anchors as Hatch primed the engines. He glanced toward the rear of the pilot house, saw the bank of complex controls, and decided not to bother. He'd find his way back by dead reckoning. His eyes fell on the large maple table, and he was irresistibly reminded of the last time he'd sat at it. Kerry Wapner, Rankin, Magnuson, Streeter, Needleman. Now, all gone. His gaze turned to Woody Clay. The minister sat in his chair, gaunt and wraith-like. He returned the gaze, nodding silently. "All is secure," Bonterre said as she burst into the pilot house, closing the wooden door behind her. As Hatch eased the boat out of the lee, a great explosion sounded behind them,
and a concussive wave rattled the rain-flecked sweep of windows. The heaving sea suddenly turned crimson. Hatch goosed the throttle, moving quickly away from the island.
Mon Dieu,
Bonterre breathed. Hatch looked over his shoulder in time to see the second fuel tank explode into a mushroom of fire that punched up through the low-lying fog, lighting the sky above the entire island and enveloping the buildings of base camp in a cloud of smoke and ruin. Bonterre quietly slipped a hand into his. A third roar came, this time seemingly from the bowels of the island itself. They watched, awestruck, as the entire surface of the island shuddered and liquefied, sending up vast plumes and waterspouts to violate the night sky. Burning gasoline spread a furious glow across the water until the waves themselves were on fire, breaking over the rocks and leaving the reef aflame. And then, as quickly as it started, it was over. The island folded in on itself with a wrenching boom as the last section of the cofferdam gave way. The sea rushed into the open wound and met itself in the middle, rising in a great geyser whose top disappeared into the mist, falling back in a sluggish brown curtain. In a moment, all that was left was a great boiling patch of sea, worrying a cluster of jagged rocks. Plumes of dirty steam rose into the restless air.
"Ye who lust after the key to the treasure pit," Bonterre murmured, "shall find instead the key to the next world, and your carcass shall rot close to the hell where your soul hath gone."
"Yes," Clay said in a weak voice.
"It was a meteorite, you know,"
Bonterre added.
"And the fifth angel sounded,"
Clay whispered.
"And I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth. And to him was given the key of the bottomless pit."
Hatch glanced at the dying minister, afraid to speak, and was surprised to see Clay smiling, his sunken eyes luminous. Hatch looked away.
"I forgive you,"
Clay said.
"And I believe I need to ask your forgiveness as well."
Hatch could only nod. The minister closed his dark eyes.
"I think I'll rest now,"
he murmured. Hatch looked back at the remains of Ragged Island. The fog was rapidly closing in again, enveloping the destruction in a gentle mist. He stared for a long moment. Then he turned away and aimed the prow of the boat toward Stormhaven Harbor.
Chapter 63. The North Coast Realty Company had its offices in a small yellow cape across the square from the Stormhaven Gazette. Hatch sat at a desk in the front window, drinking weak coffee and staring idly at a bulletin board littered with photographs of properties. Under the headline, "Great Fixer Upper," he saw what could only be the old Hagler place, broken-backed and listing gently, but still quaint. 129,500 steals it, he read off the card. Built 1872. 4 acres. Oil, heat. 3 bedrooms, 1.5 baths. Should have mentioned central air, he thought wryly as he stared at the gaping chinks between the boards, the sagging sills. Beside it was a photo of a prim old clapboard on Sandpiper Lane, set between giant rock maples. Owned these 50 years by Mrs. Lyons, now deceased. "Not just a piece of property," read the accompanying card, "but a piece of history." Hatch smiled as he remembered the painstaking care with which he and Johnny had festooned those maples, with toilet paper, one Halloween more than 30 years ago. His eyes traveled down to the next column of photos. "Main Dream House," read the nearest card, burbling with enthusiasm. "Authentic Second Empire in every detail. Sunroom, bow windows, ocean views, wraparound terrace, waterfront dock. Original fixtures, $329,000. Underneath was a snapshot of his own house.
Oh, Doris Bowditch came bustling up. There's no reason that should still be up there.
She plucked the photo from the board and dropped it on a nearby desk.
Course, I didn't want to say anything, but I thought you'd made a mistake, not budging from a price as high as all that. But that couple from Manchester didn't bat an eye.
So you told me, Hatch said, surprised by the regret in his voice. There was no reason for him to stay now. No reason at all. But despite the fact he hadn't even left town yet, he already found himself missing the weathered shingles, the clank of steel cable on mast, the resolute insularity of the town. Yet his was now a completely different kind of regret. A bittersweet nostalgia, better left to fond memory. He glanced out the window, past the bay, toward the few jagged upthrusts of rock that marked the remains of Ragged Island. His business, 3 generations of his family's business, was finished in Stormhaven.
"The closing will be in Manchester," the bright voice of Doris intruded. "Their bank wanted it that way. I'll see you there next week."
Hatch rose, shaking his head.
"I think I'll send my lawyer.
You'll see that everything's crated and sent to this address." Doris took the proffered card and peered at it through rhinestoned glasses.
"Yes, Dr. Hatch, of course."
Saying goodbye, Hatch stepped outside and walked slowly down the steps to the worn cobbles. This had been the last piece of business. He'd already shared a bottle of pop with Bud the grocer and called ahead to his housekeeper in Cambridge. He paused a moment, then stepped around his car and pulled open the door.
"Mellon!" came a familiar plummy cry. Turning, Hatch saw St. John lurching toward him at an uneven trot, trying to keep numerous folders beneath his arms while maintaining his balance on the cobbles.
"Christopher," he said with real pleasure. "I telephoned the inn this morning to say goodbye, but they told me you'd already left."
"I was killing the last few hours at the library," St. John replied,
blinking in the sunlight.
"The lass is sending a boat to take the last half dozen of us down to Portland. It should be here in the next half hour."
He clutched the folders more tightly as a playful sea breeze threatened to spill his precious papers across the square.
"The Stormhaven Library?" Hatch said with a smile. "You have my sympathy."
"Actually, I found the place rather useful. It had just the kind of local history I'll need."
"For what?"
St. John gave his folders a pat.
"Why, my monograph on Sir William MacCallum, of course. We've opened up a whole new page in Stuart history here. And, you know, his intelligence work alone will merit at least 2 papers for the Journal of the International Cryptographic Association."
The basso profundo blast of an air horn shivered the windows of the square, and Hatch looked in time to see a sleek white yacht turn into the channel and approach the pier.
"They're early," St. John said.
He balanced the folders awkwardly as he held out his hand.
"Thank you again, Mellon."
"There's nothing to thank me for," Hatch replied, returning the limp shake.
"Best of luck to you, Christopher."
He watched the historian teeter down the hill toward the dock. Then he stepped into the Jaguar, closed the door, and cranked the motor.
He pulled out into the square and pointed the car's nose south, toward coastal Route 1A and Massachusetts. He drove slowly, enjoying the salt air, the play of sun and shade across his face as he passed beneath the ancient oaks that lined the quiet streets. He approached the Stormhaven post office and pulled over to the curb. There, balanced on the end post of a white picket fence, sat Isabel Bonterre. She was wearing a thin leather jacket and a short ivory skirt. A large duffel lay on the sidewalk beside her. She turned toward him, stuck out a thumb, and crossed one leg over the other, exposing a shocking length of skin in the process.
"Ça va, sailor?" she called out.
I'm fine. But I'd watch out if I were you.
He nodded toward her tanned thighs. They still burn scarlet women around here, you know.
She laughed out loud. Let them try. Your town fathers are fat, fat to the last man. I could outrun them all, even in these heels.
She lifted herself from the post, walked over and kneeled by the car, resting her elbows on the passenger window.
What took you so long?
Blame Doris the realtor. She wanted to enjoy every last hard-earned minute of the sale.
It made no difference.
Bonterre pretended to pout.
I was busy anyway. Very busy, trying to decide what to do with my share of the treasure.
Hatch smiled. They both knew that nothing had been salvaged from the island, that the treasure could never, ever be reclaimed. She sighed extravagantly.
Anyway, are you at last ready to drive me out of this ville horrible? I am looking forward to noise, dirt, panhandlers, daily newspapers, and Harvard Square.
Then get in. Hatch reached over and opened the door. But she remained leaning on the window frame, staring at him quizzically.
You will allow me to buy dinner? Yes?
Of course.
And then we shall finally see how you Yankee doctors say good night to young ladies.
Hatch grinned. I thought we already answered that.
Ah, but this evening shall be different. This evening will not be spent in Stormhaven. And this evening, I am buying.
With a smile, she dug her hand into the sleeve of her blouse and pulled out a massive gold doubloon. Hatch stared in amazement at the oversized coin that filled her palm.
Where the hell did you get that?
Bonterre's smile widened.
From your medical hut, naturellement. I found it there when I was rooting around for the right meter. The first and last of the Ragged Island treasure.
Hand it over.
Désolé, my friend,
Bonterre laughed, holding it away from his reaching fingers.
But finders are keepers. Remember, it was I who dug it up in the first place. Do not worry yourself. It should buy us a great many dinners.
She threw her duffel in the back seat, then leaned toward him again.
Now, back to tonight. I shall give you a choice. Head or tail?
And she flipped the thick coin into the air. It caught the sun as it turned, flashing brilliantly against the post office windows.
You mean heads or tails?
Hatch corrected.
No.
Bonterre said as she slapped the coin against her forearm.
Head or tail? Those are the correct terms, no?
She lifted her fingers and peeked at the coin, eyes widening salaciously. Get in here before they burn both of us at the stake. Hatch laughed, dragging her inside the car. In a moment, the Jaguar's eager engine brought them to the outskirts of town. It was the work of 2 minutes more to reach the bluffs behind Burnthead. Just as the car topped the brow of the hill, Hatch had one last glimpse of Stormhaven, a picture postcard of memory caught in his rearview mirror. The harbor, the boats swaying at anchor, the white clapboard houses winking on the hill. And then, in a flash of reflected sunlight, they were all gone.
This has been an Hachette audio production of Riptide by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Read by Scott Brick. Produced by Michelle McGonigal. Post-production by Tom Perkins. Riptide is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group, Incorporated. Text, copyright 1998 by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Audio production copyright 2010, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.